I want to play True Confessions for a minute, and then I promise I'll tell you a baseball story. There's an email address associated with this podcast. I keep forgetting to mention it about every other episode when I do the closing credits, but there is. It's infiniteinning@gmail.com. I've gotten a few emails there, but not a ton, and that's okay. I mean, there's no obligation on your part after listening to also reach out, but I do encourage you to do so. I hope you will. And my saying that is not for the same reasons that I say, please rate us on iTunes or rate us wherever podcasts are listed. Suggest us to your cat, your friends, your family. Scrawl the name of the podcast in positive terms only on the walls of public bathroom stalls. Really anything. That's purely about my wanting this to be heard by the widest number of people. Anyone this side of Dr. Frankenstein who creates something wants his or her work to be seen by the widest number of people. You know, I work on trying to get my validation from the inside these days and not depend on praise from others, but one of the reasons that I became a writer and now that I do this is I like being on stage. So come one, come all, let me entertain you. Perhaps robotically, as I said those last words, let me entertain you. Sounds more like a threat now, doesn't it? My reminding you about our email address, infiniteinning@gmail.com, isn't about that. It's not about having a bigger audience or making more money or anything like that. It's about my wanting to have a community around this program, about, it sounds trite, but wanting to get to know you. You know, to be honest, if this isn't oversharing, it gets kind of lonely in here sometimes. And if a podcast can't expand a man's world, well, then I don't know what can. I have heard from old friends since I've started this, and that was incredibly rewarding. When people who could just phone you choose to listen to you, that's a special kind of giving in a way. But I'll tell you something else. In an effort to reverse some of my own isolation, I recently contacted an old friend from college. They initially responded with all the right warm notes, said they had thought of me often and were really keen to see me, and it was great to be back in touch. And that was 3 weeks ago. And I have reason to believe that maybe they weren't as sincere as they had indicated, and so now not only have I not expanded my world, I feel kind of bad. I promise I'm not like that. I am sincere when I say I want to hear from you, and that I thank you for listening if you've listened so far, or if you're just coming aboard for the first time, then welcome. Because I really am sincere, and I'm not at all like the guy who I'm about to describe. When I was in my first year of college, I took this class that met once a week for about 3 hours a night, and the professor said, I'd like you all to come to my office during office hours because I'd really like to get to know you as people. I'd like to know your hopes and dreams. I want to know you as more than just a name on an attendance sheet. And I thought, nah, bull. So I didn't go. A week went by, and the class met again, and he said, many of you have come by. Not all of you, though, and I really do want to know you. I want to know your aspirations as you climb the pinnacle to adulthood, what your goals are for college, what you want to learn in the course. I want to know you. Please, please come to office hours. And I thought, ah, phooey, that's for suckers. And I didn't go. Another week went by and the class met again. He said, almost all of you have now come to office hours and have shared with me your goals, your wants, your desires. And I know you as people. And I want to know the rest of you. So if you are one of the few who has not come, then please come to office hours. And I thought, well, if everybody else has done it, I guess I'll have to check my cynicism about the whole thing. So a couple of days later were his office hours. I went to his office. I knocked on the door. I waited a long moment before the door slowly and, to my mind, reluctantly began to open. And he stood there. I was ready to be welcomed. He looked me in the eye and he said, yeah, what do you want? I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Rises on an empty stage, and you are shocked to see you, yourself, walk in from the wings. You know no lines. You cannot think of a single song to sing. You've never sung a song at all. Panic sweeps over you, but finally, someone whispers, say it's episode 13. And, with much gratitude, you do. Maybe we ought to take an improv class. In a moment, I'll be joined by Stalwart contributor Jesse Spector, and he and I will discuss a variety of subjects, from whether the Mets should trade Yenis Céspedes to how delicious it would be if the Royals somehow win again. And then Jesse has a near nervous breakdown talking about Yankees executive Randy Levine, a spectacle not to be missed. I don't know if I should draw attention to this, but if I sound a little breathless, it's because ever since I started doing this podcast, a rogue grounds crew has taken to congregating beneath my window and attacking every blade of grass with lawnmowers, hedge clippers, and sometimes jackhammers. And so I'm under a lot of pressure to get this in before they return. You may be able to hear them faintly in the distance because they are approaching. It grows louder, like a mechanical tide, a clattering ocean of rotating blades throwing off gas fumes. Nonetheless, I will try to get through today's parable in good order. And my topic, kind of unintentionally, relates to the subject of our first segment. So I talked about inviting you to rate the podcast, and I happened to look at iTunes the other day, and we have a very nice pile of them now, all but one very positive. And those of you who left reviews, even the one negative one, I do thank you from the bottom of my heart for listening and spending your time with me. I really do appreciate it. As I said in the opening, this is my way of, among other things, reaching out to the world. But the one negative one, I don't want to dwell on it, but it fascinated me because, among other things, it objected to the fact that many episodes ago, David Roth and I talked about the fact that we're in therapy for various reasons, not just political ones, but that we happened to mention that back in November, the election became a topic of discussion with the therapist. The commenter said, "Way to alienate half your audience." Well, first of all, not half, never half. But fine. The bigger issue to me is that that's where the discussion happened to go. And I'm never going to lie to you. I'm not going to deflect it from a topic just because it might be controversial. And beyond that, if you listen, the discussion took place in the context of enjoying baseball and how can you continue to enjoy the lighter parts of your life when the heavier parts of your life are just very difficult to carry. And I think that's a legitimate subject for a baseball podcast, for any podcast that in a way is about a hobby, is about an entertainment. How can you keep going to the movies when you find larger, potentially life-altering situations to be weighing heavily on you? If I can figure out how to cope with that for myself, or David can, then that's a positive thing for everybody who listens if they can do the same thing. But beyond even that, why would the election upset a person to such a degree that they would seek psychological counseling? It's not just about which side wins. We are all, or most of us, old enough to have seen both sides in every flavor win and do their damnedest to screw things up, whether they're on the left or the right. And that in itself is not alarming. There's a tide and a pendulum nature to these things. No, it's about a specific person and the sense that that person violates societal norms or political norms or processes that have been in place for a long time and have protected us from some of those tides, that renders those tides placid. I think that's legitimately concerning. And at that point, the politics of the person in question are almost beside the point. It's more a concern with the system and an understanding that if you take something that has evolved boundaries over time and you debauch those boundaries, whether they will ever rebound to the shape that they were in is a question that one might be reasonably pessimistic about, especially if you acknowledge that that old shape, as hidebound as it was, had protective benefits. How do I know that? Why am I talking about this on a baseball podcast? It's because I am a baseball fan and baseball teaches us these things. Let's talk about something very strange that happened in September 1924 in the National League. That year, the Giants and the Dodgers fought for the pennant down to the very end of the season. These were the Giants managed by John McGraw, of future Hall of Famers like George High Pockets Kelly, of Frankie Frisch, Travis Jackson, Hack Wilson, Ross Youngs, Bill Terry, the entire bloody team, in part thanks to Frisch being on the Veterans Committee, went to the Hall of Fame. The Dodgers were less stacked with those guys, again, because Frisch wasn't there, but they had a lot of great players. They did have three Hall of Famers in the spitballer Burley Grimes, the hard-throwing, tattered-sleeved Dazzy Vance, and Zach Wheat, who hit 375 that year. Heading into the last weekend of the season, the Giants led the Dodgers by a game and a half, two in the loss column. Each team had two games remaining. The Giants would play the miserable Phillies, which were a team which was in the midst of about four decades of losing 95 to 105 games every year. The Dodgers had two against an even more miserable, at least that year, Braves team. It wasn't likely that the Giants would get swept by the Phillies while the Dodgers swept the Braves, but that could have happened, and I guess some of the Giants, someone on the Giants was concerned about it? That's the weird part. Before the Giants hosted the Phillies that last Saturday, a second-year bench player on the Giants, a 23-year-old outfielder named Jimmy O'Connell, sidled up to an acquaintance of his, the Phillies shortstop, a guy named John Henry Heine Sand. And in one moment, one brief moment, he destroyed his entire career. The conversation that they had was reported in different ways, but it went something like this. O'Connell went up to Sand and said, "How you guys feel about playing these games?" And Sand said something like, "Well, we don't really feel anything. We're the Phillies. We're just playing out the string." And O'Connell said, No. "How do you feel about us, the Giants, winning the pennant?" And Sand said, "Well, I don't think any of us really care. We just, you know, let the best team win." O'Connell said, No, what would you like?" Sand said, "Well, you're a friend of mine, so I'd like to see your team win it. But to be honest, I think it would be neat if we swept you and the Dodgers swept the Braves and there'd be a playoff game." Baseball fans never change. They always root for the most possible chaos, right? O'Connell said, "Well, would $500 change your mind about that? $500 not to bear down on us?" Sand said, "Jimmy, I'm not interested." Now, another version says that he responded a lot more emphatically, like this: "Get away from me. You must be crazy, and don't ever say anything like that again to me or to anyone else." And O'Connell, realizing that he's got the wrong mark, said, okay, you go out there and do your best, and look, this doesn't have to go any further than between us. It's just between you and I." The way people like to tell this story, O'Connell was kind of a nobody, but he wasn't. He was a real prospect, and he was just getting into playing in the major leagues. After the 1921 season, one in which the then 20-year-old O'Connell had hit 337 for the San Francisco Seals, the Giants ended a bidding war with the Yankees, buying him for $75,000, which was the highest purchase price for a minor leaguer to that point. They then insured him for a further $75,000 and left him with the Seals for another year, during which he hit 335. If he hadn't played much in the majors to that point, it wasn't for lack of talent, but because the Giants' outfield was stacked with Youngs and Wilson and also Irish Musial, brother of the Yankees, Bob Musial, who's less well-remembered today but was a career 310 hitter and was kind of a Hunter Pence-level player. In 52 games that year, O'Connell had hit 317. That was the career Sand held in his hands as well as his own. The reason that this was such a fraught moment for both players was that 4 years earlier, baseball had established through the resolution of the Black Sox matter that there would be no tolerance for this kind of behavior. And specifically, that Buck Weaver was banned not for throwing the World Series, but for knowing about it, for having guilty knowledge, had a chilling effect on anybody who might even go within 12 feet of betting or bribes or anything of that nature. So you're Heine Sand. Do you say yes, your opponent? Your fellow power contending for hegemony? Your enemy is asking you to do his bidding, to do something, to advance his cause and yours. He'll win, and you will win in a sense, having made $500 that you wouldn't have made as a minor player on the Philadelphia Phillies, a team that didn't really pay people particularly, a team that didn't pay a grounds crew but had sheep eat the grass. It's no small amount of money in 1924. So what do? Do you say, "I love it"? I'm asking you. Well, Heine Sand says no, but he doesn't turn O'Connell in, not right away. He didn't tell his manager, the former Giant Art Fletcher, but that increasingly troubled him. It troubled him when the Giants won, something neither he nor O'Connell had anything to do with, but he, having just had that conversation, could have been somehow deemed complicit in that loss. But I don't think that's really what it was. I think that he just was disturbed by the wrongness of it. He could have said, "I love it. I love making an extra $500. He didn't.
What he said was, and this is a quote, "I felt guilty all over. I felt guilty in this way that I did not tell Fletcher as soon as it happened, that I should have told him before the game started. But it's the first time that anything like this happened to me, and I just didn't know what to do." So he did go to Fletcher. He woke Fletcher up in the middle of the night and told him his story, and not long into the next day, the matter was in the hands of Judge Landis, who was investigating even before the World Series got started. The tale goes all kinds of weird places after this. It had very long legs. O'Connell tells Landis that, yes, he did try to bribe Sand, and that he had been put up to it by a Giants coach, Cozy Dolan, who was widely known as a John McGraw lackey, and that further he had confided in Frisch, Kelly, and Youngs, and that they had all encouraged him to go forth with the bribes. And Dolan, in testifying to Landis, answered virtually every question with, "I don't remember." I could read you a transcript of this, and there are probably 100 occasions of Landis saying, "Did you talk to O'Connell before the game?" Dolan says, I don't remember." "Okay, well, this happened 3 days ago, Cozy." "You don't remember 3 days ago?" "I don't remember." "Wait, you don't remember what happened 3 days ago, or you don't remember that you don't remember?" I don't recall." "Did you ever talk to anybody about anything?" "I don't remember." "Do you like chocolate?" "I don't remember." So Landis banned him from baseball. He banned both of them forever. Frisch, Kelly, and Youngs denied involvement, testified reasonably convincingly, and were exonerated. Dolan said that, "I don't remember" was just a figure of speech that he used to reply to most everything. It didn't actually mean that he didn't remember. But regardless, neither was reinstated. The following March, O'Connell appeared at the San Francisco Seals Recreation Park and asked permission to work out with the team. He was told to go away. He wound up playing first in an outlaw league with some of the Black Sox, and then ultimately was a laborer on the docks in San Francisco. It was a sad fate, but O'Connell insisting that he was just following orders tends to neuter one's sympathy a bit. My favorite lines in this, and I feel a little uncomfortable reciting them just because he very well may have hatched the plan in a moment of alcoholic insanity, belong to John McGraw, who said, "They were dumb. I cannot understand why these two men did what they did when the chances were 100-1 that New York would win the pennant. The only explanation I can give is that they are a couple of saps. If you would search the country over, you probably couldn't find two bigger saps." And he added, "Why should we pay one of the Phillies to lose a ball game? They get paid for losing games all year." And he was right in that sense. Why would anyone, in the aftermath of the Black Sox being banned, want to risk their careers on this? We'll never know. It's been nearly 100 years. It makes no sense. But I'm not concerned, overly, with O'Connell or Dolan or whoever else was involved in this, but with John Henry Sand, a player of no special merit who had a very short career as a non-hitting, error-prone Philadelphia Phillies shortstop. I tell you about him not because there is a political analogy in this, although there is, but because I want you to think. The other day, I was in the Frick Museum in New York, and there was a painting by Sir Joshua Reynolds on the wall, and seeing his work always brings to mind a line that is very familiar to me because it's one that my grandfather used to recite. Sir Joshua Reynolds said, "There is no expedient to which a man will not resort to avoid the true labor of thinking." And that's the value of baseball. It's not just about hits or runs or your tribal colors being attached transiently to the word championship. No, it's about critical thinking. Baseball taught Heinie Sand how to think. It taught him, perhaps through a negative example, the banning of the Black Sox and many other players who were subsequently associated with gambling, but nonetheless, it taught him that there were boundaries. I want you to consider, why is it valuable to have those boundaries? Why don't we win at all costs? Why is there terrific power in the words fair play? I don't know if I have time to answer that question in the depth it deserves in the gap I have before the lawnmowers come back. And in a way, I kind of hope you'll do it on your own. Think of all the ways that a virtuous cycle is its own reward. When you know that things are on the up and up, there's a lot of suspicion and paranoia that you can forget, or at least place to one side. That's not a weakness you exploit, but a valuable thing that you protect and defend. John Henry Sand knew that. We should know it too. I'll be back with Jesse Spector in just a moment.
now we are joined by a man who is just dripping in sang-froid, or as I like to call it, sang-froid, Jesse Spector. How are you, Jesse?
I've been dripping in sweat, mostly. That's July in New York, so, yeah.
Way to puncture the Cary Grant-like aura that I was trying to conjure for you.
I have never had that kind of aura, nor any kind of mystique whatsoever, so that's, it lasted a good 12 seconds, I think, so we're good. That's a career high.
Well, I hope you enjoyed it, at least in that time, just to know what it would feel like to be the guy who would be cast opposite Audrey Hepburn in a...
I do have a better idea of what it would be like to be cast alongside Audrey Meadows, but that's another story.
That's another version of that. It's The Infinite Inning, starring Jackie Gleason, Art Carney.
And the stars! That's my favorite part. Starring Jackie Gleason, The Honeymooners, with the stars Art Carney, Audrey Meadows, and Joyce Randolph every New Year.
Perfect, and you have a better memory of it than I do, obviously. And the thing is, if you grew up in this area, which I believe you did, and for those not immediately in my vicinity, by this area, I mean the New York area, every night on WPIX Channel 11 in New York, especially if you were a baseball fan, you might watch the Yankees game, and then there'd be the late news, and then at 11 o'clock, there might be an Odd Couple repeat starring Jack Klugman and Tony Randall, and then either a Star Trek repeat or Barney Miller, and then there would be, somewhere about midnight, there would be an installment of The Honeymooners.
Yeah, I don't think I ever, well, for one thing, by the time that I was of an age to stay up that late, the games would be on MSG.
Ah.
I kind of missed that, but for me, it was Rain Delay Theater that would be The Honeymooners, or later on Taxi and then Cheers. Oh, Taxi may have been Channel 9.
I think so. The problem for me was, as much as I love Taxi, as much as it was a almost perfect sitcom, if there can be such a thing, just from that theme song on, I felt really depressed. It was a downer in certain ways. You might watch Jesse Orosco blow a save, and then that lonesome flute solo. Yep, and there's this cab just endlessly driving over the bridge, never arriving, which was the theme of the show, basically, that you had these lost souls collected in a garage and never actually getting to their destination.
I don't think you could actually cast that any better than Judd Hirsch.
No, you can't. You can't. Absolutely not.
And the rest of the cast is obviously stellar as well. I mean, Tony Danza, Marilyn Henner, Danny DeVito, Andy Kaufman. That's stacked. Christopher Lloyd.
Yes.
Taxi doesn't get brought up enough as far as when people talk about best sitcoms. Maybe because there's... No, it's not because there's not memorable episodes. There's plenty of memorable episodes. Pretty much anything, any episode centering around Andy Kaufman as Locke is just, fantastic.
With Carol Kane coming in and...
They all get their moments to shine, yeah.
I think part of it is not that many people watched it during the first run, so maybe even in syndication, maybe not that many people picked up on it.
I don't know. I did not watch it during the first run. I was too young.
Yeah, no, even I was fairly young, and then this was a kind of unprecedented thing at the time. It got canceled by its original network, and it bounced to a second network. And I feel like it went from ABC to NBC, something like that. So people understood that it had value, but it just didn't have that mass audience that would later greet Cosby, if we dare speak his name, or Family Ties, or those kinds of shows.
You are correct. It's 78 to 82 on ABC, and then 82 to 83, one season on NBC.
If only that could have happened for Star Trek, which NBC stuck on Friday evenings and sort of killed that way.
The show was on for 5 seasons, 3 Outstanding Comedy Series Emmys. That's like if Mike Trout got run over by a bus tomorrow. That's the level that we're talking about. It's sick. You heard that cast. That's incredibly good. And the writing was fantastic. You can't do much better than that. Did I miss anyone in the cast?
Danny DeVito, who's just pretty much pure id in that role.
You know what? It's funny. I think that one of the reasons that I haven't been able to fully get It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is that in that sort of role, I can't get past Danny DeVito being Louie.
You know, one of my favorite roles for him is the voice of the satyr in the Disney version of Hercules, which is, I think, as Disney films, and I don't know if you're an animated movie guy, but I mean, I have kids, so I've had a built-in excuse. But to be honest, I would have been going anyway because I love the artistry of animated films. And I feel like that one is very underrated. It has a very solid score. Unfortunately, it has this sort of big pop single in the middle that I think was recorded by Michael Bolton that they were trying to sell and be another whole new world, like, you know, Aladdin, and have a crossover hit. But the other songs are much better. The comedy is very good. And for some reason, that it just didn't catch on as much as some other Disney pictures did.
I barely am aware of the existence of this film.
Well, you have young children, so there.
I do.
There's a chance for you.
I'll be catching up, to be sure, in the years to come on all of those Disneys. So we'll see.
Well, you know what? The great joy for me, and again, I kind of started doing this without them, so I can't wholly credit them for this. Mm-hmm. But you will have a chance as they get a little older to watch the Miyazaki films, the Studio Ghibli films, with your kids, which kind of pick up where classic Disney left off, except they're a little bit darker in places. And I mean, something like Spirited Away is one of the best movies that I've ever seen, whether animated or not. Princess Mononoke is this tremendous ecological fable with a lot of adventure in it. And it's a long list, and I won't recite all of them, but these are just terrific hand-drawn films in a way that they don't make here anymore.
I am honestly just looking forward to being able to watch Wallace and Gromit without it being too scary.
That penguin can make you a little nervous, but that's one of the funniest films I've ever seen.
The Wrong Trousers is my favorite.
Yes, that's the one I'm talking about. The name wasn't coming to me, but that's the one with the evil penguin as the villain.
Yeah.
We always inevitably get to the Mets, you and I. And yeah.
Do we have to?
We don't. Well, I have a question I've been thinking about today, and I threw it into my column for this morning about why various teams won't win, and doing the Mets capsule for that is kind of shooting very obvious fish in a barrel. They've said they're going to be sellers at the deadline, as they should be.
Sure.
And that they're going to be focused on the guys who are not under contract, obviously, the many rentals that they have. Curtis Granderson, Jay Bruce, et cetera, Addison Reed. I sort of thought, you know, there's a good argument for Yenis Cespedes being included on that list. Now, he is signed. He signed for another 3 years at a fairly high price. I think they owe him another $80 million or something like that. But he's injury prone. He doesn't stay in the lineup. He's going to bring more of a return from a contender than any of those guys on that list of 36-year-olds that they're trying to delete. And his durability is not going to get any better as he goes through his age 32, age 33, age 34 season. So my question to you is, am I crazy? Or does it make sense to move him over some of those other guys?
Let's get it out of the way first that he does have a no trade.
Yes, he does. He did. And I did acknowledge that in the piece.
That's important to keep in mind. It's not crazy to think about shopping him for all of the reasons that you state. The biggest reason not to is you're paying him this money. You're going to have a team full of, especially after you either trade away Bruce Granderson, Duda, Addison Reed, whoever else goes. You're going to have a team full of young, cheap dudes. It's not like paying him is going to stop you from doing whatever else. Even, you know, being the Mets and being a middle-of-the-pack payroll team despite playing in New York because of all their issues and la-di-da and twiddly-dee. There's only so much that you can punch a group of people directly in the crotch. And to trade Cespedes after getting basically half a season out of this deal, where he's been hurt for most of it, when everybody was so excited to have him back, I can't see it. I can't see, like, if there's a team that would do it, yeah, it's them. But even the act of going to ask him to waive the no trade clause is just like, why would anybody come here ever again? I can't wrap my head around it for that reason. And I'm not usually big on, like, oh, you'll alienate the fan base, fans will always come back, you know. That is what it is. But this one crosses a line for me that you can't go there. You sign this deal. This guy is your guy. He's going to be injury prone because he's just full of tightly wound muscles. I think that, you know, we've seen that from the debut core strength video that he had all those years ago. You can't trade that guy. You just can't do it. And in a way that I feel like you could make a better case for trading Noah Syndergaard than you could for trading Cespedes.
I was talking on this show about Ricky Henderson last week and one of the times that Ricky Henderson was injured. And Cespedes reminds me of him. They're very different players other than sharing left field. But they both had about 0% body fat and were incredibly sculpted and were seemingly held together with piano wire. You do understand why the guy would go twang to, sometimes. Yeah. As you said, there's just not a lot of room for error in a body like that. As perfected as it is, it almost seems rigid in some ways.
I think that him being flawed in such a marvelously self-boosting and yet self-defeating way is why he's perfect for the Mets anyway. So why mess with a good thing? But it's tough to watch that. And you get to a point when you're over 30. Like, he didn't have these problems early in his career, but he has after 30. And you know, Ricky was just a pulled hamstring waiting to happen at any given moment. And usually, you know, 3 or 4 times a year, it seemed like.
The one severe problem that he had, which was in 1987, which was what I was talking about, the mystery for me, I guess, is that the diagnostics were apparently not there or were not consulted. So this is a little different than Cespedes, where they do have this kind of follow-through. I shouldn't assume that, given what happened with Syndergaard and the non-MRI earlier this year. But Henderson was apparently just kind of felt up by the team doctor and the trainer, and they said, no, his hamstrings are fine. And then subsequently, well down the line after a great deal of controversy, they sent him for what is termed in the papers x-rays, and I don't know if that's actually technically correct.
Probably not.
But it was only at that time that they diagnosed that he had a complete tear. The thing about Cespedes, I think, is that he is showing a more repetitive lack of durability than Henderson, who had just those couple of big injuries.
Yeah, and I feel like my memory of Ricky in that way is probably flawed by being a 6-year-old in 1987 who was, you know,
no excuse,
into the Yankees. And that's it's not, but it is. It's like Jamie Eisner and Alex had this thing going on Twitter today of who are guys that you think of as the wrong team. And for me, it's like, it's guys from that time. Like, I think of Dave Parker as a red. I think of Carney Lansford as an A. I don't even think of Ricky as an A primarily, except for the later A. Like, I don't think of his early A's work because I wasn't conscious of it. Like, that's all stuff I know happened. I know he set stolen base records wearing the green shirt with white Oakland across the front. You know, I think of him, he's either one of the Yankees of my youth or a complimentary Bash brother or one of the dozen other teams that he, you know, a Blue Jay or a Padre or a Met or a Dodger or Red Sox or whatever else, for crying out loud, that he was. Ricky's a Newark Bear to me forever. But it's that kind of thing where there's always a piece of your baseball knowledge base, fandom, whatever, that is influenced very heavily no matter what you do about it. Like, I know Dave Parker was awesome in the 70s for the Pirates. It does not matter. I think of him as being like a mid-80s. He's an RBI guy for the Reds. That's what he is. And yeah, he's an RBI guy. I think of him as an RBI guy, which is something that I think of zero people as post-1996.
Right. I mean, there's a similar thing for me. Like, I'm also a bit young to remember Dave Parker as the guy who hit .330 with awesome defense for the Pirates. I more remember him as being kind of this overweight, slow, low on base percentage guy for the Reds who did drive in a bunch of runs at least 1 year, I think 1985. Similarly, Frank Tanana was the fireballing complement to Nolan Ryan with the Angels. But the guy that I saw and who pitched for both teams in this area, the Yankees and Mets, when he was about 90 years old, threw about 80. and was that guy, was very successful as that guy post-arm injury. He was very successful that way for a long time, and I can never get the image of him as a strikeout artist into my head, no matter how much I know that it's a real thing.
To me, he's a Detroit Tiger, a soft tossing, you know, the Jamie Moyer of Jamie Moyer's youth.
So to close out this Mets thing here, this is the list of free agents. You got Jay Bruce, who's 30, Curtis Granderson, who's 36, Jose Reyes, who's 34. And whereas I'm no fan, I do have to admit that after a miserable first 3 months, he's kind of hitting right now. Neil Walker, who's 31, Addison Reed, 28, Lucas Duda, who's 31, Fernando Salas, who's 32, Rene Rivera, who's 33. That's the complete list of forthcoming Mets free agents. And I would posit...
I don't think you named the most important one.
Rene Rivera?
No, Asdrubal.
Oh, true. Well, he's under option. That's why he didn't pop up. He has a $2 million buyout on an $8.5 million team option, which you'd almost pick up in a way if you thought he'd be happy to be there in kind of a flexible role. But I don't think he would be happy to be there, having asked to be traded. So, yes, you throw him on the pile. You can throw Jerry Blevins, who also has an option. But I would like to posit that even with those guys included, none of them are going to bring you the Aroldis, Chapman, Andrew Miller kind of return that I think teams are now looking for, or what the White Sox just got for Jose Quintana. There's no reason to throw huge first-round draft pick kind of guys at the dregs of Curtis Granderson's career, or even, and Jay Bruce is having a good year, kind of loath as I am to admit it. That's why I feel like if you really do want to make a splash, I don't know if the Mets are even interested in that. I understand what you're saying about Cespedes. I keep thinking this is the team that of Tom Seaver and the Midnight Massacre. So that either proves your point or disproves it. I'm not sure which, to be honest. I feel like you have to at least talk about it.
To me, more likely is, I think there's a reason that DeGrom's name keeps popping up. And I think that he's not a stupid person to think about trading based on what you can get for him and what his future might hold. You know, of all the pitchers that they have, yeah, he's the one that's been healthy, but he's also not as young. It took a while to get here, so...
29 this year.
You know, you're not talking about a guy who's 23, 24. And the FIP has gone up year after year after year since he was Rookie of the Year. I don't know exactly what you make of that, but he's still got team control through 2020. That's a guy that you could really do some business with, and I think that you can make that case of, yeah, this is why we're trading him. You know, this is going to be Syndergaard's staff, basically. And you're admitting defeat on Generation K2 or whatever you want to call this group. They never really did come up with a name for it, and that's fine. Maybe that's the direction that you have to go. I think that the thing that to me is more likely and that really makes the most sense for them, because you still, like, 2020 is a good ways off. Like, you can come back with DeGrom next year and still, if you feel like trading him, get that Quintana package for him. I would look at what the A's did last year when they packaged Rich Hill and Josh Reddick, knowing that as rentals, they weren't going to get a blow-away package for either one of them, but they're able to package them, send them to the Dodgers, and come back with Jarrell Cotton and a couple other pieces. That's the way that you kind of have to go with this. It's like, is there somebody out there that can use Jay Bruce and Addison Reed? And I think those teams exist. I don't know exactly who that is off the top of my mind, but it's somebody.
More broadly, they not only have all those free agents, but they have also a good 10 arbitration cases coming up, one of whom is DeGrom. And so what do you have really left under firm contract for next year? Cespedes, David Wright, who probably is a sunk cost, even if he does someday get back onto the field, even if it's this year, you don't really know what's left. Arguably not much. He's barely played in a long time. There's Cabrera, who I assume will be gone. Lagares is under contract, and Lagares is not an everyday guy, and it would probably be kind of depressing if he was an everyday guy. And then you have, I mean, arguably you could non-tender Matt Harvey. You have Wilmer Flores, who's eligible for arbitration, Travis d'Arnaud, Zach Wheeler, Syndergaard, for that matter. These are guys who are complicated. Obviously, Syndergaard you're going to keep under contract and pay. And then
what I'm hearing right now is this team is doomed. Just, oy. I haven't thought about it like that. It's just, that's bleak, grim, sad noises.
And it's hard when you have to delete that many guys. I mean, we were talking about the 1990s Phillies before, and I was thinking about this year's Phillies, who are on a pace to lose close to 110 games, and this is supposed to be the year after they hit bottom. And they've started promoting some of the guys that they're supposed to promote, and it's still not good. The thing is, they're called prospects because they're prospective. Like, it doesn't necessarily always happen that they just click into place and voila, Mike Trout. Like, there's an alternate universe where Mike Trout is not Joe DiMaggio. He's a guy who came up and had a 295 on base percentage or something, and we talk about him as a potential fifth outfielder. Now, that happens sometimes. So there are no guarantees, and it pays to be proactive. I've always written that, and I'm not a religious person, so you can call this God or the universe or divine providence or whatever, but either you decide when to rebuild or the universe will decide for you, and the Mets are at that spot. So that's, again, why I'm kind of obsessing over this point.
Yeah, I will say this for the Phillies, at least to make their case for them. They were in a position where they had no choice. And yeah, you're getting prospects back in the deals that you make, and you're getting high draft picks and doing all that you can to add talent to your team. And maybe it hasn't worked out to this point. I think that we have to caution ourselves that just because guys are coming up now and they're still on 110 loss pace, that doesn't mean that this won't work out. And I don't want to go fully trust the process on this, you know, to stay Philadelphia related, because it's not that simple. It is baseball. It is very much the possibility that you have these highfalutin prospects and they come up and, you know, like you said, 295 on base and see you later. But they at least got themselves to a point where they cleaned out just everything, and they don't need all of the prospects to click. They need a few of them to click. And then, like, in 2 years, when that bonkers free agent class hits, they have pretty much nobody under contract. And by that, I mean, like, they have Odubel Herrera, and that might be it. They are well set up to be enormous spenders in free agency, in a very good time to be enormous spenders in free agency, at a time that they should, at least. You would think if you've got 10 prospects that you like, at least 3 or 4 of them are going to pan out. You're probably not going to go 10 for 10. That doesn't happen. But, you know, if you get 3 or 4 decent players to build around, and then you can supplement that with giant free agent class, then you might have something. So I think that this does eventually work out for them. I don't know where the end game is on this for the Mets. It's going to be fair to wonder if 2015 was their one real and true shot at this, and it just didn't happen.
Yeah, I think you're right that sometimes a team builds to a high point. I think this happened with the Pirates beginning in 2013 as well, that kind of the window opens and closes a lot faster than you think. And then you're stuck with a kind of hangover where it's time to rebuild already. And you say, wait, we just got here. You have to acknowledge that, yeah, and that's as long as you get to stay. By the way, you're right about the Phillies, that all they have is under contract is Odubel Herrera for forever at reasonably low prices, or at least compared to most other, I don't know that he's a star baseball player at this point, but on the Phillies he passes for one. He's signed through 2023. And that's part of the problem, not so much that he signed, but that he has also gone backwards, at least so far this year. Michael Franco has gone backwards so far this year. So it troubles me that the guys who are good and that they've established are not building on this. There are more prospects to come. It makes you a little twitchy that J.P. Crawford, who was considered one of the best prospects in baseball going into the season, has also had a fairly miserable year at AAA. So you feel like whatever ingredients they're putting in the soup, if it's coaching, if it's something else, it's not quite where it should be, but it is still early yet.
It is. And I think that there's a... I want to go back to what you said about the Pirates as well. The Pirates aren't alone in that, because the Royals are facing the exact same thing. The difference is the Royals got a ring out of it. Like, the Royals had a window that opened in 2014, it's going to close after this year because all these guys are coming up for free agency, and they are pretty much in a position now because of the way that they turn things up at the end of the first half that they can't be sellers and break it up now. But the breakup is coming. They're just not going to get anything back for these guys unless they make some of those trades where they're like, all right, you know, we'll do a contender trade where we trade you a rental for a guy who's under contract. And I don't know exactly how that works for them. I would imagine the Royals either buy or stand pat at the deadline. The Royals got a ring. The Pirates and Mets didn't. And going back to it, you know, we talked about the Mets before, middle of the pack payroll team being in New York. We're putting the Mets in the same conversation as the Royals and Pirates. And if you're a Mets fan, that should be the thing that continues to upset you most of all, is that the Mets are always lumped in there with those teams and not with Yankees, Red Sox, Dodgers, you know, the teams that share giant markets and should be run in a certain way to be constantly either rebuilding on the fly or contending. The Yankees, once again, are in this position where I don't think the Yankees had an expectation coming into this season of necessarily even being a playoff team, but here they are, continuing to do it. Maybe the Yankees did have that expectation because they have that belief in themselves. I certainly didn't think that they were, and I've been surprised pleasantly by what they've done on the field, but that's what they do. They haven't had a losing season since the early 90s, since 92. That's the kind of thing that the Mets should be striving to be and the way that they should be operated, and I'm not saying, like, yeah, the Mets can very easily go out there and not have a losing season for a quarter century when the Red Sox have finished dead last, like, two of the last 4 years. It's not how it works for everybody. But you can't be talking about the Mets in the same breath as Kansas City and Pittsburgh. Like, that's just, that ultimately goes back to ownership, and that is the biggest problem with the Mets, and has been for a while.
Well, let me draw another contrast with the Yankees and the Mets for you, and this doesn't necessarily have as much to do with overall payroll, but with philosophy. And this has been a glaring thing that people have been talking about with the Mets all year long. So the Yankees uncharacteristically have become a youth-oriented team. And this is something that if you've been following them, and whether you're my age or your age, you overlap with the George Steinbrenner years, you realize this was not something that they were ever into. In fact, they actively resisted it in every way possible. They opened the year with a 24-year-old first baseman, Greg Bird, and Aaron Judge, who's 25, in right field. They also have a young catcher in Gary Sanchez. Some of that works out. Bird gets crazy hurt, which I want to talk about. When those guys, whether they establish themselves or go down, they bring up Tyler Wade, who's 22. They bring up Tyler Austin. Once he gets healthy, he's 25. They just acquired a first baseman from the Brewers organization who at 26 is a little ripe for a prospect, but still he's a virgin major league player. They're giving him starts every day. They've had Miguel Andujar, who's a third baseman prospect, coming up. They were going to give Dustin Fowler time in the outfield. He destroyed his knee in basically his first inning of play. So he goes down. They bring up Clint Frazier, who's 22 and was one of the guys they got in the deal last year for Andrew Miller. And the reason I list all these guys is they consistently have thrown youth at the problems that they've had, and they've cut loose guys like Chris Carter, Carter made it easy for them, excuse me. Typically, he's the kind of guy that they would have given a ton of rope to. The Mets, to the extent they have prospects and they don't have that kind of farm system, they will not bring those guys up. It makes no sense at all at this point to have those guys sitting in Vegas.
There's been no explanation given for Amed Rosario not being in New York other than that these guys are cheapskates. That's all it keeps coming back to. And I think there's something interesting also that you touched on there. You named all those guys that the Yankees have used, position player after position player after position player. The Yankees are loaded with young position-playing prospects. And look at what the Cubs have done in their rebuild. You know, it's Chris Bryant, it's Rizzo, it's Albert Almora, it's even adding Jason Hayward as a young guy, it's Addison Russell, it's Wilson Contreras, it's Kyle Schwarber. The Mets built around all of these young pitchers. And here in the early 21st century, what happens to young pitchers? They break. They fail. Some of them come back okay, but the attrition rate is going to be a lot lower than if you have hitting prospects who click and hit it at the major league level, those guys are going to stick, and those guys are going to be able to provide you with multiple years of quality baseball in a way that you just cannot depend on pitchers. And yeah, the Mets, it's been particularly tough for them to see what's happened with Syndergaard and Harvey. Like, that's not something that you would necessarily expect. But when the foundation is built on the elbows of 95 to 98 mile per hour throwing young men, you're asking for trouble in a way that you're just not when what you're building around is the core of, you know, positional players. And you can even think back to the Yankees and using the word core. Yeah, the core four was Jeter, Posada, Rivera, and Pettit, and the guy who gets left out for some reason that I will never understand, and it's an absolute Shonda because core rhymes with four and not five. I guess that's the reason. Bernie Williams.
Yes.
And the only, like, Andy Pettit is the only starter of that group, and Mariano was a failed starter. You could go out and get David Cohn, Jimmy Key, Roger Clemens, David Wells, El Duque as an international free agent. You can get pitching. It's a lot harder to fill your team. And I think that this is something else that the Mets have kind of run into. Like, they got Cespedes. They had Daniel Murphy, and maybe, I'm not going to say the Mets didn't know what they had in Daniel Murphy. I, for one, am surprised at what Murphy has done in Washington, that, like, somehow it really was clicking for him in the 2015 playoffs, and that wasn't, like, just 2 weeks of God mode for him, that he was actually finally figuring things out and putting it together. But, like, I like Lucas Duda a lot. Lucas Duda is not the kind of guy that you build a team around. You know, David Wright broke down, too. But even if David Wright hadn't broken down as dramatically as he had, he was a guy who was coming towards the later stages as they got good here, and they had to go out and trade for Cespedes. They had to go out and do all these things. They didn't develop that kind of sustainable core group that you have to do with position players because pitchers break down.
Just to be fair to the Mets, the Daniel Murphy free agent case between 2015 and 2016 is one of the harder ones that I think any team has faced in recent years, in that you have this guy who's 30 years older, coming off his age 30 season. He's a good hitter, but not necessarily a great hitter. And he's not a good defender at second base. And he doesn't necessarily, at that stage of his career, out-hit that. And he's looking for a long-term contract. And he's going to be heading into his decline years, at least in
theory,
at least insofar as you can reasonably project. And against that, you have, like you said, 10 days of God mode, basically. And you have to measure or guess as to whether that's a transient thing. And most likely it is a transient thing. I mean, look, this is a world in which Pat Borders won a World Series MVP. Mm-hmm. These things happen. So I don't know if there was a right answer there. I think it's very cool the way it worked out. And he's having this kind of George Brett second act to his career, or at least for two straight years plus the playoffs now. But I don't know that anybody would have gotten that right.
No, I think that they, especially when you're able to go and trade John Neese, who is terrible and was terrible, and get Neil Walker because the Pirates feel like they can't possibly. That's one that just boggles. That's one that the Pirates can point to as sort of the beginning of the end of their whole deal here. And I think this is something that happens to your small market teams. It's kind of what happened to the Expos. It wasn't that they stopped having, you know, the kind of ability to develop guys. It was that they just weren't able to keep making the kinds of trades when guys came of age to be traded that they were able to refresh and replenish the same. And I think the same thing wound up happening to the A's after a while as well. And the Pirates are going to look back on trade. And even though maybe Neil Walker doesn't re-sign there, but trading him to the Mets for John Neese, who you wind up trading back to the Mets for, was it Antonio Bastardo, who was terrible?
Yeah, he's gone from there.
Yeah, what a disaster for them. The Mets had no complaints with Neil Walker last year before he got hurt, or this year before he got hurt. Like, he's just gotten hurt, and that stinks for them and makes not having Daniel Murphy look that much worse. But I also feel like I have very little doubt that had Daniel Murphy re-signed with the Mets, he would have gone right back to being Daniel Murphy, just because that's the way the universe works when you're the New York Mets. Like, he'd be hitting 240 with a 290 on base and a 315 slugging and 5 home runs, playing garbage second base, not able to shift over to first, not able to figure out anything at any position in the field, because that's just how things work. And I'm not even a Mets fan. I'm just... on like 26 teams, he would have gone right back to being himself. Like, he goes to the Nationals, and that's the team that the Mets are in direct competition with. Of course, he winds up not only tearing apart the league, but killing the Mets every single time he sees them. It's just a glorified, glamorous version of what happened with Justin Turner in so many ways. After they non-tendered him, probably rightly, but also stupidly, never really gave him as much of a chance as they should have. And
well, they badmouthed him going out the door, and he's proved to be
they did that too.
Team leader with the Dodgers. At least they did give him something of a trial, unlike the Orioles, who had him momentarily and sort of sniffed and passed him on without giving him any kind of playing time. I want to tie everything
together. The Orioles got theirs with Melvin Mora, as far as guys that
that's true.
Let go for no reason whatsoever.
I want to tie all this together into a broader thing, in that the Yankees do have two young starters who I probably should have mentioned in that pile of guys that I talked about. One who came through international scouting, that's Luis Severino, who's 23, and the other who came through domestic player development, that's Jordan Montgomery, who's 24. But some of the guys, the higher profile draft picks that they've had insofar as pitching, have been much slower to develop due to the usual entropy, the usual arm injuries, the usual just lack of execution that happens with pitchers. But one of the most vivid quotes from Theo Epstein in Tom Verducci's book about them that came out this spring is, and this has resonated with me over and over again as the Cubs have gone through their difficult season, was as they went to rebuild the Cubs, he said, "We can get anybody to pitch." And so they piled all their draft picks on the guys that you mentioned. The high picks went to Chris Bryant and guys like that. And for one shining season, they were able to combine starters who were very good, not necessarily great, surround them with one of the best defenses in Major League history, have the good luck sustained for a single year that not only did those guys have incredible range and were able to get to lots of stuff, but balls were actually hit to them as well. That doesn't always necessarily happen, and I think it's happening less this year. And they win a World Series. They win a historic World Series, given that it breaks this 2,000-year slide that they'd been on. I feel like with the Mets, I even feel like we've been through this movie before, and I don't know if you've had the same sense of deja vu I have with Syndergaard and Harvey and those guys, because I feel like I watched this happen with Paul Wilson and Jason Isringhausen and Bill Pulsifer and those guys 20 years earlier.
We have seen this before, and Theo's absolutely right. You think about that, you can even extend that to a guy who hasn't been hurt, like Jake Arrieta. That guy, and it wasn't last year that he was top of the world amazing, but 2 years ago, and he was still, a high-flying guy last year. He's still a formidable pitcher now. He's not somebody that you're like, oh, I'm, chomping at the bit to go face Jake Arrieta, but he's not in the Cy Young conversation anymore by any stretch of the imagination. He's sitting there with a 4.17 ERA, 4.25 whip. Even John Lester, who's 33, 99 ERA plus, their rotation has been meh, pretty much all year. That's been a big problem for them. And Kyle Hendricks was right there last year. He's been hurt and not that great. You need some of the pitching to hit. So they go out and they get Jose Quintana. And Jose Quintana was having a not all that great year with the White Sox. Comes over and goes and throws 7 shutout innings with 12 strikeouts in his Cubs debut, so maybe that works for them, and they could be getting together to go on a run. I certainly have said before, and will say again, that I will not be the least bit surprised to see the Chicago Cubs back in the playoffs this year. It's they're too good of a team offensively to not at least make a run at it, even with sort of a league average-ish pitching staff like they have. What stands out to me, they're third in on-base percentage of the National League and 8th in runs scored. That shouldn't really necessarily line up. And 5th in home runs, so it's not like they're not hitting the ball out of the park either. It's just, it's not all there with them. They certainly have the capability to get back there. And I don't know if it's going to be because the Brewers falter or because Colorado or Arizona falters. And all three of those are teams that you would say are capable of faltering and letting the Cubs, if they go on a run, get back in this thing and go to October. When you get there, you have pitchers who maybe despite having bad seasons do have track record and can pull those games that you need to pull out of your butt. And that's how you win another World Series sometimes.
I do believe that was Branch Rickey's out of your butt theory that he promulgated somewhere in the mid-50s. I think you're absolutely right. And just sort of mathematically, it's going to take both the Cubs getting hot to a degree they haven't been hot this year, and then also someone in front of them not continuing to do what they're doing. If only one of those happen, if the Cubs go on a run and everybody keeps winning at about the same rate that they're at, then the Cubs are going to have to play at like 105 win pace the rest of the way. And I don't know if they have that in them. They certainly had it in them last year, but that's kind of the point, that you can do this thing with the pitching staff on an ad hoc basis, particularly the starting rotation. I mean, bullpens get reshaped every year to some extent, just because relievers are so unpredictable for the most part. But that when you build around pitchers, you may possibly have longer term consistency. You may not, as the Mets have not, with all the arm injuries. The consequence for the Cubs, at least, is that when these guys faltered this year, they couldn't reload.
And at the same time, as of 12 months ago, as of 4 months ago, wouldn't you have said that the Cubs, in addition to, you know, being built around the position players, also were set pretty well as far as pitching, when you have Lester, Arrieta, Hendricks as your top three, and then you can kind of just fill in, like, oh, maybe Mike Montgomery becomes a useful starter. John Lackey is still there. Brett Anderson is there. You've got guys who are there. Like, it's not like they were completely bare and like throwing stuff against the wall and hoping that it would stick as far as starting pitching went. They had these guys. Three of them are on the DL, haven't been necessarily or at all good. These are name brand pitchers who have, for one reason or another, had letdowns this season, and that's just the way that it is. That's kind of how pitching goes, especially in this era. I don't know if there's any real legitimate fix for that. It's not usually this dramatic, and it's certainly not almost never as dramatic as what's happened with the Mets over the past two seasons. But even the Mets, like, figured, oh, you know, if things go wrong, we'll be able to fill in with Seth Lugo. We'll be able to fill in with Zach Wheeler. And that's just not always the way that it goes.
In fairness to the Cubs, whereas I do think that putting all their eggs in the hitting basket and not having the second line pitching in the minors does play some part in it, they also have had a perfect storm of maybe the pitchers letting up to varying extents, a little or a lot. And then on the offensive side, there are a lot of guys who just aren't quite as good as they were last year, at least to this point. So it all kind of adds up into a disappointing thing. And at the risk of beating the Mets to death, I'll offer you a parallel there too, which is in the season after their World Series win in 1986. I mean, they had a spectacular starting rotation that year. But going into 1987, Dwight Gooden gets popped for drugs for the first time, so he disappears into rehab. And Sid Fernandez's weight started affecting his knee. And I'm just doing this from memory, so I may be getting some of this wrong, but Bobby Ojeda's elbow went and Rick Aguilera's elbow went. And then they brought David Cone up as a rookie, and he went to bunt, and someone threw a fastball off one of his fingers, so he disappears onto the DL. And basically everything that could go wrong for this incredible staff did go wrong. And then the next year, 1988, they had more health. And I realize that's a bitter year for Mets fans, but they also won like 105 games and arguably were the best team in baseball that year.
Yeah, 88's a bitter year for Mets fans because of what happened in the lottery that is October baseball when you play good teams. We see it every year that so many playoff series just come down to three balls one way or another. And that's it. That's the way an entire team's success. Like, you're either partying in Cooperstown or wondering what the hell went wrong and muttering to yourself in a lounge chair in Phoenix, Arizona, 25 years from now, based on two or three balls over the course of a week of baseball. And yeah, no, the 87 Mets, and I did call up their baseball reference page, had one starter, and this is in 1987, one starter make 30 starts.
Ron Darling.
And it was Ron Darling.
Yeah.
He made 32. Sid made 27 plus a relief appearance. Gooden got back, made 25. Their fourth most common starter that year was John Mitchell, 19 starts. Rick Aguilera, 17 starts. Cohn, 13. Terry Leach, 12.
Terry Leach.
Ojeda only got in there for 7. Don Schulze, 4. John Candelaria, 3. Tom Edens, 2. Jeff Innes, 1.
Right. They were so depleted that they were going for veterans like Candelaria at the end there.
Yeah, they used 12 different starts. John Candelaria was only 33 that year somehow, despite having been around for 45 years prior to that. He's got a weird mustache on his baseball reference page in the pillbox Pirates cap. He looks like a scoundrel in this photo. Got better as he went along, the Candyman, as he got acclimated to life as a New York Met. And then the next season he was gone from there and gone across town to the Yankees, where he had a nice season.
He had a great season, and then he decided he didn't want to start anymore the next season. He wanted to be in the bullpen, and that soured the relationship very, very quickly, because that's not what they needed him to do at that point.
Yeah, their problem was always starting pitching.
Yes.
We're talking about not at exactly that time, but the same era of George Steinbrenner calling Lou Piniella and telling him, I just won you the pennant, I got you Steve Trout. Because, I mean, what'd they have? They had Mattingly, Winfield, Henderson, Randolph. That's the group of a real good team that they had there, and never had the starting pitching to go along with it.
They couldn't do it. They had Guidry pitching well every other year, a pattern that broke down at about the moment that you're pointing out. And then guys who, like Candelaria, had great moments at other times and had excellent careers, be it Phil Negro or Joe Negro or Tommy John or any of those guys, but you were asking them at literally 45 years old to be regular rotation guys and top starting pitchers for a pennant contender with just no one at the front, no Roger Clemens, no Dwight Gooden, and none of the guys who were the leading starting pitchers of the day, just these relative senior citizens. And again, Phil Negro was tremendous fun. Tommy John is one of my favorite pitchers in history, and could get 4 grounders for every fly ball he allowed, and just a tremendously fun guy. But it really was senior league baseball, and it's a ridiculous way to try to win anything.
And then they also had their share of guys that were decent and young that they would then get rid of and would blossom elsewhere, like Drabek and Tewksbury.
And Tewksbury was one of the guys who was traded for Steve Trout.
Yeah.
So we've zipped through an hour here in what feels like record time, and
it was the same amount of time. That's how time works.
That's like a pound of lead and a pound of feathers, which is which is heavier. It's really about your perception of a pound of lead and a pound of feathers, or in this case, my perception of an hour, 13 minutes. What I wanted to ask was, regardless of all our talking about youth with the Mets or Yankees or the situation with the Cubs, it is going to be a disappointment, right, if we don't end up a few months from now in October with Astros Dodgers?
Is it? I don't know. I don't know if that's disappointing. I think it depends how we get there. I would be perfectly happy seeing that World Series matchup. You know, it would mean either the Astros winning for the first time ever or the Dodgers winning for the first time since 88. That's good stuff I like to see. I don't know if it's disappointing if that's not the way that it winds up. I don't know. I don't feel like I'm compelled to see an Astros-Dodgers matchup in the way that I was disappointed. Like, the last time that I recall feeling actual disappointment in not seeing a sports matchup was not this year, but 2 years ago, when the 73-win Warriors team didn't wind up playing the Spurs in the playoffs. I wanted to see that matchup because I thought the Spurs might be able to handle them. As it turned out, Cleveland did. So, you know, we got a real good series out of that anyway. I don't feel that way about baseball so much of the time that I need to see Team X from the American League against Team Y from the National League, especially when Team X from the American League is the Astros, who I still, to this day, maybe someday it'll change. They're a National League team and always will be.
Yep, absolutely. Well, real fast, let's run through the possible storylines,
yes.
Right? The Red Sox go to the World Series. Well, that's not that special anymore. That their curse was broken in 2004. They've won it every other year, it feels like. I'm sure that Red Sox fans will disagree, but that's something we can feel kind of jaded about. Cleveland goes, okay, they haven't won anything since 1948. There's a certain romance to that. The Astros have never won, and they're winning 2/3 of their games, so that's pretty special.
Nationals, former Expos, never won. This is a team that's been on the verge for a long time. That would certainly have a certain amount of emotion to it. Brewers haven't been there since 1982, have never won. There's something to that. Cubs repeating and kind of cementing the dynastic aspect of their team, I think there's something to that also. And then you have the National League West, which is the Dodgers, as you said, haven't won since 1988, are playing ridiculously high level. And I guess some of this depends on how much weight you put on just regular season performance, which can be distorted by all kinds of things, schedule and other fluky things. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the postseason or how you perceive the postseason, but I kind of do. And then the Diamondbacks and the Rockies are both possible wildcard teams. The Diamondbacks haven't won it since 2001. This would be a very unlikely Cinderella story given how rundown they were last year by the old management. And of course, the Rockies have not won it as an expansion team. They got there once before and lost. What storyline most appeals to you of all those?
I'll throw in another one because we talked about them before. The Royals.
Oh.
What if the Royals win a third pennant in 4 years and second World Series in three? And then immediately are forced to break everything up because of, not even because of financial reasons, just because of the fact that everybody's a free agent, except for Alex Gordon, who's like the worst player in baseball, pretty much, by his numbers at this point. That would also be cool. Like, Alex Gordon comes up and has, like, just, you know, a Daniel Murphy postseason to lead the Royals to this mini dynasty World Series win after they were an 84-win team winning the American League Central. That would be wonderful and hilarious on so many levels that if my mom has gotten to the end of this, who still carries a grudge against the Royals for the Pine Tar game and the 70s before that, she'll disown me for saying this, but that would be the funniest and greatest thing of all, is just the Royals winning 84. Alex Gordon carries them through the playoffs. Like, Jason Hammel pitches his mind out, and I would be endlessly entertained by that. And also all of the resultant idiotic takes to flow from it would just be... Red Sox Cubs would be cool too.
Yes, it would.
Yes, we've seen both teams win, so it's not what it would have been in 2003. But
the Royals thing, it would be wonderful. You're right. I hadn't thought of it that way. The problem is, I think that given that they're last in the American League, if not in baseball and team on base percentage, they haven't even 300 as we speak. They don't hit for that much power either. They're slugging 409, which is also,
they're not good,
pretty low down. Like, they seem incredibly unlikely to follow through on this. And yet, like you said, they're in an impossible place because they kind of have to trade. They don't have that much of a farm, and they need to replenish it by any means necessary if they're going to stay on the horse. And at the same time, you can't break faith with the fans at this time.
Yeah. No, they're not good, but they win. And that to me is funnier than when they were good in 2013 and didn't win.
Real fast, last topic of discussion, since I brought it up earlier. Greg Bird, last week, an unnamed Yankees executive, trashed him to Bill Madden, implied that he didn't want to play because he had this nonspecific ankle injury that the doctors were saying was, no, it was really fine. They implied it was all in his mind or that he was lazy or something. Turns out, as of today, when we're recording this, that he has os trigonum syndrome, which sounds like something Harry Potter would say, but it refers to having some extra bone growth down in your ankle, and when you move around, it presses and pulls on the wrong thing, and you have a lot of pain. So he's going down for surgery. And my question is, does unnamed Yankees executive, whoever it is,
Randy Levine.
you said it, I did not. Does he step up and apologize?
Has there ever been a more obvious unnamed source in the history of unnamed sources than Randy Levine being the source of that story? Unless it's like Montrose sneaking in, coming in off the outside rail to hip him at the end. Like, that's so Randy Levine. Bill Madden, 2 days earlier, had another unnamed Yankee source. No, what? It wasn't an unnamed Yankee source. He was going back to Randy Levine's on-the-record comments because Betances was struggling, and Madden tweets out, like, this is a guy who thinks that he's a $5 million closer. In what strike zone is that? And, yeah, $5 million is what Jim Johnson is getting paid. I'm pretty sure Dylan Betances is worth Jim Johnson or Santiago Casilla money in 2017. Relationship there of who would say such a thing about Greg Bird, and then who wrote it. is the most obvious combination in the history of obvious combinations that I feel pretty confident in saying that that's who it was. And no, he will not apologize because that guy never apologizes because he's, words to use to describe Randy Levine. I don't have anything nice to say about the former deputy mayor under Rudy Giuliani. Thinks that he knows anything about baseball.
Well, that's the interesting question. What fascinates me is of the Yankees hierarchy, I understand what role the Steinbrenners play. I understand what role Brian Cashman plays. I even understand what role Lon Trost plays.
Sure, he's a business idiot.
Something like that. But Randy Levine was hired at the time that they were trying to build the current Yankee Stadium because he had that relationship with Rudy Giuliani. They wanted a guy to smooth whatever municipal political type stuff came up. Okay, I don't know whether he did or did not do those things, but that day is now long gone, and he's this vestigial presence, and I'm not sure what purpose he achieves beyond random sniping.
Yeah, I have nothing to add because I completely agree. He has no purpose beyond random sniping. Anytime that he opens his mouth, whether on the record or as an unnamed source, it winds up causing a great deal of embarrassment. You have a guy who's now been to 4 straight All-Star games, and you're sniping with him, you're bringing arbitration, which is a hard enough process as it is. You bring that public and something to continue to harp on through your mouthpieces in the media. Who is that benefiting? Is it benefiting the team when the multiple-time All-Star drafted by you from his hometown relief pitcher winds up going somewhere else because you were a jerk to him both privately and publicly? Whose interest is that serving? Whose interest is anything that that guy does serving? And did they really even need him to smooth out political things? Pretty sure that they were going to get that ballpark one way or the other anyway. Because the Mets did too. At the same exact time. And the Mets have no political abilities beyond tripping over their own 2 feet and stumbling into whatever it is that they stumble into on a regular basis. I don't mean to bring this back around to looking and pointing at the Mets and saying, oh dear God, there but for the grace go any of us. No, that's just like, I don't know what purpose this guy serves. And please stop me from talking because it's not an enjoyable guy to talk about. He's a bad person. Like, he's just bad. Why? Why do I have to think about Randy Levine? Let's end on something that's happier than that, please. Is there something happier?
Disney fired Kermit the Frog this week.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, they did. I do think that by accident we've stumbled upon the definition of this and many other podcasts, no purpose but random sniping. So there's that. We now have a mission statement.
Welcome to the Randy Levine Show, most popular show on the internet. Hooray!
There you go. And on that note, Jesse, thank you for coming by, as usual, taking your spot in the rotation, and we will talk to you again directly.
Every fifth day, or whatever it is that I, whatever you need me for.
Double duty Jesse Spector, we call him. He works both ends of the doubleheader.
We'd gladly do so with you, Steve. Thank you.
Well, as Benjamin Franklin once said, cowabunga, we've made it to the end of another podcast. You can find Jesse Spector at Twitter, at Jesse Spector. Simple enough. And you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because these days going on a major airline just seems like asking for punishment. As I discussed extensively at the outset of the show, you can write us at infiniteinning@gmail.com. And of course, you can rate us at the podcatcher of your choice, iTunes, or anywhere else that podcasts are collected. I greatly appreciate it. No sponsor today, but let's just say we're brought to you by the number 4, not the one you think. I asked Jesse Spector how he rated our producer's abilities, and he said,
terrible, and was terrible.
Our theme song, which you have been listening to throughout the episode, and in fact are listening to right now, was composed by myself and Dr. Rick Mooring, whose magnum opus, The Obscene Cab Driver, had better get finished before automated cars render the title an anachronism. Go Ricky. Well, as the old joke goes, as long as I don't put on my shoes backwards and get a bloody nose walking into myself, I'll be back next week with David Roth, and we'll have more tales and discussion from inside the infinite inning.